all the hackers and the crackers. To the hackers and the crackers. I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll school you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISOs? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones? And NASDAQ leave you flat on your back? Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack.
This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial codes, source codes, ISOs, RAMs, ZIP 6. Dedicated to the hackers and...
Good evening and welcome to Binary Revolution Radio, episode 94, coming at you on Tuesday, May the 3rd, 2005. Then my co-host, of course, if you don't recognize by the voice, is
NotTheory.com.
NotTheory. I'm still floating on a little bit of a high from Freak Factor this past weekend. Saturday night, the debut episode of Freak Factor on DDP Hack Radio, which was a successful failure? A failed success?
Well, I guess it depends who you ask.
I don't know.
If success is measured by how many people were there, it was a success by far.
And I had a blast. I thought it was very successful as far as me laughing and having fun. And even though you and I pretty much were on the phone working out bugs and bouncing ideas around and putting out fires as the whole thing was going on, we didn't really even get to hear everything. But all in all, I think it was a success. A lot of people had fun. And, well, let's see where this goes. But first, why don't you listen to this as we go into email. Actually, before we read the first email, there is one little comment I wanted to remind people. I've said it once or twice before, but just to refresh everyone's memory, we do get a large volume of email, and quite frankly, so much so that I cannot read them all on the air. Please understand, we can't read every single email that we get. I try my best. Along the same vein, the ones that we do get, rambling emails, generally I'm going to have to edit those down if I'm going to even read them at all. I'm going to try to cut them down to certain parts, so don't be surprised if a couple paragraphs or a lot of your emails get chopped down to just the part that I think the listeners would want to focus on the air. So keep that in mind when you email. Short, sweet, to the point, give us facts, corrections, information, or whatnot, and you'll be more likely to get it on the show. So that being said, our first email here comes from Sen. Okay, Sen says, from CNetNews.com, the Recording Industry Association of America, better known as RIAA, R-I-A-A, said Tuesday that it would file suit against students at 18 universities accused of trading files on the supercharged Internet 2 network. And I have tiny URL'd this big link from news.com. It is tiny URL 4AJKA. But the reason I wanted to read this email on the air is because I wanted to clear up some misconceptions about Internet 2 or I2 and the I2 consortium. And I've actually worked with it, and I think you said you had a little experience with it.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I had a few friends that were at a university that was using it, and they told me a little bit about it. But I don't really didn't really follow it too much because I can't get on it, so not very interesting to me.
Yeah, and it is generally you'll find it at universities, but it is, you know, they use the term supercharged in here, and let me tell you, it is phenomenally faster than anything you've ever seen before. And it's due to the nature of what Internet 2 is all about. I worked at a university that was part of the I2 consortium. And basically what that means is the Internet 2 was formed to run parallel with the Internet, basically. And I'm not going to water this down because I know our listeners understand how the Internet works and that there's all the switches that are transferring packets from network to network and the combination of networks and all that. Well, the Internet 2 is basically an invite-only, if you will, version of the Internet. And there are requirements to be a part of the Internet 2 consortium. One of those requirements is a large sum of money. You have to be able to put a large amount of money to even join and be a part of this. Secondly, even more money is required because you have to meet their hardware requirements. Anybody, quite frankly, and not theory, I know you can back me up on this, anybody can put their network on the Internet very easily. And you can throw it up there at just as easily as people at home. You can even put on a dial-up, your dial-up connection at home, and run a server from it. And we all know, anybody who's ever used one of those sites or gone to a site that's hosted off of dial-up or even off of cable modems and DSL sometimes, how horribly slow they are. There's no minimum requirements. There's nothing that stops anybody from getting on the Internet. And that is a great thing, don't get me wrong. However, the Internet 2 is very, very different. The Internet 2 does have requirements. And I cannot read the specs to you offhand, unfortunately, but they are easily found if you search on the Internet for them. But basically, they have very high hardware requirements. And the Internet 2 is supposed to be a consortium of universities and research facilities to be able to share information. And one of the things that it was, that originally it was to be pushed for, was for a lot of online learning things. They wanted to be able to do streaming video, streaming audio, and stuff like that. And I think as everyone who's ever tried on the normal Internet to stream stuff, it's hit or miss. Sometimes you can get good throughput, sometimes you can't. And it depends on the site, it depends on the path that's taken there through the Internet, whether you get hit on a slow hop somewhere along the way, whether you have a nice clean connection. There's so many factors involved. Well, with the Internet too, since everybody has the same minimum requirements, and those requirements are very high, it basically punts off all those slow connections. So imagine the Internet without all the slow connections, no dial-ups, no DSL, no nothing. You have to have huge, huge. I think you have to have T3 or higher, first of all, just to even be involved with it. I think you have to have a T3. And I can tell you from experience that if one Internet 2 university connects to another one, it is blinding fast. I would connect sometimes to, like, I think it was Duke University was also part of it, and download, like, Red Hat. This was a few years back, a Red Hat distro, 600-some megs, 700 megs, and it would be downloaded in a minute or less, like 30 seconds. It was just blinding fast. It was so fast that the hard drive was the bottleneck, not the download. It actually took it longer to write to the hard drive than it did to download the data. It was just amazingly fast. That's a fantastic thing. It's not to replace the Internet, as some people might seem to believe. It's nothing to do with replacing it. It's basically people have built their own worldwide network. So that's really all the Internet 2 is. I don't see any privacy implications. I don't see any dangers. Other people have talked about social security number to get on board and yada yada. No, normal people can't really connect to it unless you're going to commit all that money, and even then you have to be accepted by the consortium, which is only given to universities and, like I said earlier. So that's what Internet 2 is. Now, this particular story, to bring it back to the email, this particular story is that because, you know, college students are really what pushed the Internet a lot in the early years, because universities back then were the only things that were on the Internet. As it started to grow and become commercial, that changed. But just like back then, university students, college students, would use it to share files, to go on MUDs, to start news groups, all these things that came out of it. Well, the same thing is happening with Internet 2. There are even specialized applications, peer-to-peer applications, that only work on I2. So basically, the RIAA cannot they're having problems finding the people that are doing this because, and this happened before on the regular internet, they're actually threatening the university, saying, give us the names of these people. We're finding people that are using Internet 2 to swap our movies and files. It's the same story from the regular internet. It's just moved over to i2, which is enormously faster and everything. And then just because it goes over i2, once those people have it, they can in turn share it out onto the regular internet. So it's really no different as far as the story itself. It's the same story we've heard for years. They're trying to bust people for this stuff. It's just that they can't do it right now. The internet's two universities that are involved in this are defending the students right now so far. They're refusing to give that information out. And quite frankly, I don't even know if the Recording Industry of America, the RIAA, is a part of i2. I don't know how they found out. I would be interested to see if they're even an official member or not. But anyway, that's what the story is about. That's what i2 is. I just wanted to clear some of that up.
Now, wait a second. What type of addressing scheme do they have? They still have regular IP addresses? That's it?
Yeah, they still, for example, if you go to, again, what was it, Duke I use, Duke EDU, same thing. Hmm. It's just the way the switches handle it. Your local switching inside of Duke, when you make a request, let's say you make a request to, I'm going to make this up, I'm going to assume UCLA, being a large university, is also part of it. If I send a request to ucla.edu or something like that, and I'm making up an example, you understand, your local
right.
switching is going to say, you know what, I recognize that you're going to another i2 university. And it passes that switch through the i2 connection and not out to the public internet connection. So sitting there in the university as a student, if you go out and try to surf the web to yahoo.com, it's going to switch you out through the local normal internet connection. But if you go to a recognized i2 facility or a participant, you will go on the i2 backbone. So your local switching will handle that, and vice versa on the opposite end. So you'll get a clean pipe. Yeah, it is. It's phenomenal. And you will literally, when you see something downloading, you download a giant file, my mouth dropped open the first time. My jaw dropped. I was like, holy cow, did you see how fast that downloaded? It was amazing. Amazing. So anyway, that's what the i2 is all about. The privacy concerns that people have had, I don't quite understand or get those, but you know, it's not like an individual can get on there, so individual privacy rights don't come in unless a story like this comes up, and we'll see how this plays out. All right, let's see. Next email comes from Amy. Ooh, a lady. Amy says, "Oh, so do I do a chick voice here? Do I do a I like to do voices. All right, I'm going to do I'm going to pretend Amy's a Valley girl. How about that?
Yeah, like, do it. Go for it.
Hey, Stank Dog and Honored Associates. I just wanted to say I love your show. It is humorous and informative! Exclamation point. I am a new listener, and you have my attention. I have been into computers and related activities since the old days, as in the Zork and Leather Goddesses of Phobos days. Yes, I am old, but hey, I still look good, so whatever. I can't believe I think I just snapped. I don't know if that got picked up.
I heard it.
I don't know if the radio picked that up, but I actually just snapped. God, that's horrible. Anyway, I just wanted to drop you a line to show my support and appreciation. You get me through the nights at work. Keep up the great work, guys. And by the way, I love Dr. Pepper. Oh, God, I was the worst chick voice ever.
Yeah, that was terrible. Yeah. And now all of the female listeners, all three of them are going to be like, oh, Stank Dog doesn't like women.
What a chauvinist
bastard.
Okay,
we're not going to listen anymore.
Yeah. Chauvinist bastard. They're just lost three listeners. Good job.
Well,
you know what? Actually, though, but here's the thing about this. You know, I appreciate the email from Amy, and it's all good, but there were no pictures. What the fuck? Where's the pics?
Hey, did guy hackers ever send you pictures?
Isn't it a rule that chicks on the internet have to send naked pictures? Isn't that a rule? Isn't that part of, like...
Oh, yeah, I think they passed a law about that recently.
Yeah, that's like the terms of service or something.
It's called, like, the Can Boobs Act or something like that. I don't know.
Oh, man. Yeah, so what do we have here? We have a chick who's into hacking. She looks good, according to her, and she likes the show, and she digs on Dr. Pepper. Now, wait a minute. This is, like, a dude, right?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to make of this. So, Okay, we're going to cut the email extra short today because we want to give plenty of time to our main topic tonight. It's going to take a good amount of time to cover, so we're going to make sure we dedicate plenty of the show to the main topic, and maybe we'll catch up on emails on a later show. So one of the questions that we get a lot from new members in the hacker community and people that come in and ask, one of the most frequently things we hear besides the Hotmail thing, is what language should I learn? What computer language should I learn? What's the best language? What's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so we thought we'd kind of do a rundown of computer languages. I won't say like a top 10 list, but just a different list of different types and what they're used for. Are they very prevalent? Are they good for hackers? Are they not good for hackers? Are they? Where's the money at? What's the job market demand? Kind of just do an overview of a bunch of different languages and which ones. Of course, this will be very opinionated of what we like and don't like and things like that. So I think the best thing is to just kind of start and go down a list and both of us kind of say what we have to, what we feel about it. What do you think?
Yeah, go for it. Throw some languages at me. Let's see what's going on.
And these first ones are going to be super quick because I think we can easily agree that BASIC, for example, what is it? Beginner's All-Purpose Symbolic Instruction Code. I know that off the top of my head.
Whoa, okay. Ooh. Now I have mad respect.
Yeah. BASIC, crap. Hated it. Moved on. Nobody uses BASIC anymore. Not plain old BASIC.
Yeah, unless you're talking about like a very beginner, like high school programming course, you're not really going to see it anywhere, and you're definitely, unless it's Visual Basic, you're not going to get a job programming in BASIC.
Right, and we are going to touch on Visual Basic specifically later. I actually keep that separated from BASIC. BASIC, I think the only application or use of BASIC is, like you said, in high school, to teach you programming concepts in a simple way so you understand looping and you understand sequence of line numbering and things like that. It's kind of like a beginner programming language to get you into the mindset, if you will.
And you learn to use go-tos, because that's important.
Oh, yeah, you got to have go-tos and go-subs. Don't ever use a go-to, ever. That's the programming rule. That's the golden rule of programming. Never go-to. Although that's actually not the case. I use go-tos occasionally on... Well, I'll bring that up when we come to a certain language.
Okay.
Next thing, these are not in any order or relationship, so I'm just kind of firing shotgun here. Shell or batch programming. To me, they're both very similar. Batch programming being Microsoft's old BAT files, if you remember back in the early days. And shell scripting, which to me those things are very similar without going into a technical debate. They're both sequential ways of doing things, getting things done. Bat files, pretty much gone. I don't know of anybody that still uses bat files for anything anymore. Although I think, I wouldn't swear by this, but I think they are actually still supported. I think you can write a batch file and it will still work even in XP. But I don't think anybody actually uses them anymore for anything.
Actually, I do know a few people that still use batch files for like logon scripts to like Windows NT servers and crap like that. Outdated stuff, but it's still out there. And you know, companies, like you said, they don't see a reason to upgrade. So
true.
If you're doing some sysadmin work, you may run into them somewhere, and they're easy as hell to understand. They're not nowhere near as versatile as real scripting languages. So.
And on the same token, shell scripting, which I do consider very similar, although it's, I think, quite a bit more powerful than batch. But shell scripting, I think, is alive and well. Unix boxes, shell scripting is incredibly handy, and in my experience, and you probably have more experience here, but in my experience, I used that a lot for making backups or executing programs, actually. When I had programs, I set up a cron job or something like that, launch the shell script, and what I would have it do is in stage one, like rename a file as a backup with today's date. I can pass system parameters like date and directory and home directories and whatnot, and copy the file over, then execute my new program to create a new data file, then, for example, FTP it somewhere, whatever, a sequential series of events. And that is something that, quite frankly, never really does get old. You can always use that.
That's very true, but if you really get into shell scripting, I'm not much of a shell scripter. I use Perl scripts for pretty much everything. But if you really know a lot about, you know, the C shell or Bash, the born again shell, you can write pretty much anything in these shell scripts. If you want to get really crazy with it, I'm pretty sure I saw somebody write a web server in Bash script.
Wow.
So, yeah, you can do it all. But for most people, like you said, they're going to write something simple that's sequential, that you know, maybe has a couple of if statements in here and here and there, and you know, kind of guides the execution, but nothing really all that complicated. It just gets a quick job done, and that's what I think it's best used for. And I use them all the time, much as you do.
Right, and that gives us a great segue, since you mentioned it. I'm going to make the next one Perl, because I'm going to, we agree on this, but you just said that you might use a couple if statements or something like that in your shell script, and I pretty much use born again, just bash is pretty much all, and corn shell a little bit. But, switch to Perl, because if I'm going to do any logic almost whatsoever, I'm not going to bother with bash. I'm going to go to Perl.
Right.
Now, I'm going to come right out and admit, I don't know Perl. The little bit of Perl that I've done, I think you've given me some Perl code to look at before a long time back. You might have forgotten, probably.
Yeah, I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, you gave me some Perl stuff a long time back that I looked at and modified. I know I've gotten stuff from Nick. I found stuff out on the web. I've done maintenance programming of it, so I am not a Perl whiz. I'll admit that up front. However, I do know when I would use it. If I've got some kind of more detailed logic or any kind of looping whatsoever, that's when I would look to Perl as the answer beyond bash, beyond any shell script. I would then look to Perl, and Perl, I think I can safely say, is the hacking language of choice, because A, the whole Unix, Linux, it's, you know, dominant in that market, if you will. And it is surprisingly powerful, considering it's a shell, it's a scripting language.
Yeah, well, there's still a lot of debate. Some people say it's a real programming language. Some people say it's a scripting language. Some people, if you ask them, what's the difference between a scripting language and a programming language, there's no distinction. I don't really know that there is a solid distinction between that nowadays.
Compiled?
Perl, what's that?
Compiled?
Yeah, but you know what? There are Perl compilers.
Hmm. Why would you compile a Perl? Never mind.
You know, I've never seen anybody use it, but I know that it exists.
Okay.
I don't know how well it works, but I know it exists.
Okay.
but yeah, just the fact that it's compiled does make a difference, but there are ways to compile scripting languages. Some of them are actually very tricky, written by hackers. They essentially run the interpreter for the scripting language and take a snapshot, a memory snapshot, and dump that into a file. And later on, they don't need the interpreter. They essentially just load the whole interpreter and script from the snapshot of RAM and execute it from there. It's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, and another thing that Perl is very, very good at is variables, passing parameters and variables. It's very good to manipulate with almost any kind of data or text-based input or output. And you'll see it a lot of times, people will write Perl scripts to parse through a website or parse data in and out of a website, in and out of a database. Just as easily as a lot of other database languages, Perl is powerful enough to do that. So if you're ever out there and you're like, wow, this website has a whole lot of stuff, I wish I could put it into a spreadsheet or a comma-separated file or into a database, that's when I would think Perl, go out there, parse through it, use regular expressions to dig through things, pull what you want, and export it however you want.
Yeah, I use Perl for a lot of, you know, extracting and text processing and stuff like that, putting stuff in databases. And Perl just has so many modules and so many language constructs that are designed to do exactly that, that it just makes my life so easy. I use Perl for pretty much everything.
Very, very powerful. And if somebody is comfortable with Linux and is interested in learning a language, my personal recommendation is to learn Perl. If your goal is for hacking and to be able to do something quickly on the fly, write some code to do something, I think Perl is your best bet, assuming that you're familiar and comfortable with Linux or Unix of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, well, let's see, where should we go from Perl? Let's drop back to something a little bit closer to machine level, and let's talk about assembly.
Okay, I have to tell people. I've heard people say, oh, nobody uses assembly language anymore. Everybody programs everything in C. It's not true. people still make embedded systems, and they require assembly language. So if you're thinking about learning it, not only is there a chance you can get a job as an embedded systems developer, but you will know a lot more about your machine and a lot more about what it can do, just in the general sense of what it can and can't do, and things that it can do but maybe can't do so efficiently. So you may, be able to design algorithms in your C, C++ programming better because you know that the machine can do one thing better than it can do another. So you write more efficient code. Whether you use assembly language or not, as long as you understand the instructions, the instruction set and the architecture from learning assembly language, it's going to help your programming pretty much everywhere.
Well, you don't get the only thing faster than assembly would be actual machine language. But who's going to write ones and zeros?
Yeah, that's true.
So, also, you said the word, but assembly is based on architecture, different for different
right.
type of processor architecture. So x86 being the predominant architecture out there, you can't write something, if you write something for your x86 processors, you're writing something, it's going to work only on those Pentiums and supported x86 architectures. You're not going to be able to take that and expect it to run on a Spark machine or any other architecture at all.
Right,
so
exactly.
It is
and
somewhat
it gets,
limited.
It gets even more fine-grained than that because there's 386, 486, Pentium, Pentium Pro, Pentium 2, Pentium 3, Pentium 4, Athlon, K5, K6, K7, all of these things. Each one adds a few little instructions here and there that the other processors may not have. So if you want to use MMX or MMX2 or SSC or any of those things, you got to be careful that it's going to run on all the machines that you want it to run on. So even if you learn assembly language, you got to be careful that you might be using the correct architecture, but, like the sub-architecture, if you can call it that, you have to use the correct version of that, too. Otherwise, you can get yourself in trouble.
All right. Now, you say this is still used out there, but what kind of job market is there? And actually, since we've talked about that, what about Perl? Is there a big job? Hackers can use it a lot. It's very handy. Is there a job market for Perl? And on a different note, is there a job market for assembly?
Okay. For Perl, I think the job market is not actually for people who are programming in Perl. I think it's for people who are sysadmins of a place that has a large, Unix, Linux installation, that need people to automate backup scripts and automate things that are complicated enough where you'd want an actual programming language like Perl to take the job. So if you're going to learn Perl and you think you're going to get a job programming Perl, it's probably because you're doing some type of IT or, sysadmin type work.
Right. Right, and the only reason, and it's kind of with shell, too, I'm sorry to interrupt, but same thing with shell. Nobody hires a shell coder, exactly. It's just assumed that since shell is pretty much a straightforward batch-type language, a sequential language, that it can be easily picked up by your existing programmers. And just like with Perl, like you said, your system administrators should be assumed that if they need to get the job done, whatever it happens to be, and they need to have the Perl skills to do it. I don't know that I've ever seen somebody hired to be a Perl programmer. I haven't seen that title where that's someone's sole job responsibility is to write Perl programs. I've never seen that in my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And what about for assembly, though?
Like I said, embedded systems, if you're going to work on, computers and cars or something like that, they may have C compilers. A lot of these embedded environments where you're building really small hardware like a Linksys router or something like that, or a car computer, like I said, or a cell phone, they do have higher-level languages for these things. But when you have, a very custom piece of hardware like that, somebody has to make the software guts of it, and it's all going to be an assembly language. So there are jobs out there, writing software for cell phones. If you're not writing Java applications or something like that, you may need to write, the actual system-level software. And those guys get paid a shitload of money in places. So, I've seen job advertisements for people doing that type of job, starting salary $90,000. So there are jobs in assembly language, but it's more, when you're looking for a job in assembly language, they either want somebody who's got a lot of experience in a particular architecture, from what I've seen, or they want somebody who has a little bit of experience in some architecture to get the feel, kind of like the general idea of how assembly language programming works, and they're going to teach you a specific assembly language. I got a job at some point where I had to learn a specific assembly language that was Spark-based with some digital signal processing instructions and very interesting and cool stuff. But you know, they knew that I knew assembly language beforehand, which is kind of why they hired me, and they wanted me to adapt over, you know, between 12 and 18 months to this new hardware, this new platform I had never seen before. And I did, but it's a long, hard road. So if you want to do it and you get a job, you know, you look on a site and say that they, you see that they want somebody who's familiar with assembly language, any assembly language, you may get paid a lot of money, but be prepared to work your ass off.
Yeah, and just another little note, if you are considering going in that direction, generally at universities and colleges, that usually I see under the computer engineering, electronic engineering, and the College of Engineering, as opposed to the College of Business or the College of, it's usually in the College of Science. So I generally, when I've seen assembly taught, and I've been to several different universities, it's almost always in the engineering track. So if you are interested in that side of things, you're going to end up probably in the College of Engineering, not the College of Business. College of Business focuses more on some of the other languages we're going to hit in a few minutes.
Yeah, and actually, depending on the university, it may not even fall into the computer science category. A lot of computer science places are all about theory and you know, efficiency and all this other kind of stuff. They're not really about programming, which blows people away. But definitely computer engineering, like I said, where you're building these small embedded systems, they're going to want you to know some assembly language at some point. If it's a very serious program, possibly like a five-year master's program, they're going to want you to know some assembly language so that you can really get down to something, build some something, you know, a circuit with a microcontroller and program it directly. So
yeah, and
that's what you should expect.
And I suspect, as Dan from the Linux Links Tech Show earlier mentioned, you might see a lot of that also at the vocational tech schools, that they'll emphasize that type of thing. All right, a couple other quick ones we can skip over practically is Pascal and or Fortran. I actually learned both of these languages in high school, and I've never, ever, ever seen them in use anywhere in the job market, first of all. I have seen and heard that they are used on occasion, but mostly in like scientific places where people are using them to write little data analysis and things like that, but for the most part, and maybe you know otherwise, but for the most part, I've seen these replaced by C, C++.
Well, funny thing about that, I know Fortran is still used in scientific you know, applications, like you said. I knew the physics department at the school I went to, every single thing they did was in Fortran. First of all, because somebody wrote it a long time ago and they kept adding on to it and didn't want to rewrite it because it's complicated stuff.
Which is very common.
And there actually are some modern, you know, Fortran environments. I believe Microsoft actually has a visual Fortran available somewhere. I could be totally crazy, but I remember seeing it somewhere. If it's not Microsoft, it's somebody else. And Pascal, ironically, Pascal still is in use. For writing Windows applications and Linux applications, there is Borland Delphi is you know, it's a rapid application development system, and it's programmed in Pascal. I've seen job offers for people learning Pascal. Not many. I'm not saying learn Pascal and go out. As a matter of fact, I'm saying don't learn Pascal because I think the job market is small. But if you see anything Borland Delphi experience required, that's Pascal. And if you see, I think it's called Kylix for Linux. That also is Pascal for writing graphical applications. It exists, but I do not recommend that anybody learns Pascal. I recommend you learn Fortran if you want to do, you know, experimental particle physics and you want to write software that analyzes your data. You're probably going to have to learn Fortran. But other than that, I would avoid them.
I would recommend avoiding Fortran for the simple fact that it's a strict, I don't know what the term is, but you need, like, coding sheets, you know, to do Fortran. Column 1 has to indicate whether it's a continuation from the previous line. Column 7 indicates whether it's a comment line. It's very rigid on where you, everything has to line up. Like, it's a throwback to the old punch card days. I would say avoid it for the sheer inconvenience of what the nature of the way the damn thing is.
The languages that are like that, other than Fortran, exist. Like, Python in Python, everything has to be lined up. So it's not always a bad thing, but I see what you're saying in Fortran. I've seen Fortran programs and things kind of look like indented in all kinds of weird places, yeah. And there's a meaning behind it, but I sure as hell don't know what it is.
It's a mess. It is a mess. And you'll find a lot of go-tos in that environment as well. But on to the next language, which kind of falls into this as well. You say it's a good segue. You mentioned that you've seen Fortran, and it's been built upon and built upon because they didn't feel the need to change it or take the time to change it. It's in there. It works. You modify it and add some features. Well, that's what's kept this programming language alive and will into the foreseeable future, and that is COBOL. And people always use COBOL as a joke of the dinosaur language because of its association with mainframes and whatnot. COBOL is still alive and well, and there are jobs for COBOL programmers. Now, they are disappearing by the day. Don't get me wrong. It's not a growing language. But there are quite a few jobs out there and quite a few places for the exact same reason. These companies, especially large companies, I don't care what anybody says, it is very difficult. It's a rare case when you have somebody like Google who's developed a server farm that has the power to do what needs to be done. Most places still rely on mainframes. They still rely on AS400s. They still rely on heavy metal systems to get this stuff done. And the software that was developed and written to run on these things 10, 20, 30 years ago are still around because they do the job, they get it done. You constantly modify and add to them as needed. And there was a huge push recently, well, I guess not so recently, but with Y2K, where there was a huge job rush of COBOL programmers that were needed to convert a lot of stuff to Y2K compliance. That's really where the biggest problem and concern with systems was. It was with those old heavy metal systems because the software was so old, nobody ever thought they would make it to the year 2000. And when it did, there was a huge job rush. Now, there still is jobs out there. Again, I wouldn't recommend young people going into college and, like, focusing on COBOL or anything like that. But be aware that there are jobs out there for COBOL programming. It's horrible. It's hideous. It's god-awful to actually write COBOL. And I have done it for several years. I had done it at an old job, and it was miserable.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
It's a combination of structured language, where it does have to start in certain columns and certain things have to come in a certain order. And it's the classic example of spaghetti code, if you've ever heard that term. It's not it's not necessarily go-tos, although I found a lot of go-tos in some old COBOL code, and I had to rewrite so much stuff because it was just a mess. But the way it's structured, you do a lot of, for lack of a better word, we'll call them function calls, procedure calls, within other calls, within other calls, within other calls, and then sometimes they would break out of the whole cycle. So you'd be five or six levels deep, and all of a sudden something will break out of that cycle and go off in a completely different direction and break the sequence, and then you're lost. I mean, it's memory. It's horrible. And COBOL programs, even the most simple Hello World in COBOL, is going to be three to 500 lines of code. And that's not an exaggeration.
Oh, man. Well, I got to tell you, you said that a lot of people, there was a job rush for, year 2000 fixes. I don't know how long these kids are going to be living, but, you know, maybe there's going to be a job rush in the year 2100. So, if you're looking for some advice, I'd say, you know, right around 2090 or so, start learning COBOL. There may be some systems left you get to update and maybe get paid $1 million a year. Who knows?
Yeah, nobody will worry about that till 2099.
Yeah, of course.
So, all right, well, that's COBOL. Now, along the same lines, as long as we're talking mainframe and heavy metal, there are a lot of other languages that a lot of people have never heard of or seen before, and I'm just going to lump them all together and call them report languages, report writing tools, reporting languages, that are very much like you said earlier, too, reporting languages, like, for example, EasyTrieve, EasyTrieve Plus, Focus is a very big one in the DB2 world. Focus is used a lot. These are used, again, on mainframes, some Unix and stuff, but their original intent was to be a short language to let you write quick reports. Very SQL-like, if you will. I used to jokingly refer to Focus. A lot of people I used to work with swore by Focus, and I used to always just say Focus is nothing but SQL on crack. It's nothing but sequential query language, which we're also going to talk about just a second. It's basically give me A, B, C, and D, and print it out on the screen. You don't get a lot of control over the formatting of how it comes out, but you can easily generate a list. Somebody says, hey, give me a list of all of these people who make more than this amount of money. Focus is great for stuff like that. Report writing languages are great for stuff like that. The problem with this comes where people start trying to use these languages for something they weren't intended to do. So like as the language evolved, they started doing, like you said earlier, with Perl, where new modules would be come out that you could use to do a lot of other things. What should have been kept as simple reports, and if you ever need something more detailed, like laying something out in a nice designed report, would be used in a different language, COBOL, unfortunately, I'd have to admit, or something like that, for mainframes or C or whatever. But what they started to do is build all this extra functionality, like the ability to do different joins and sorts and things like that. Well, you know what? You should do that in an SQL program first, and then use your report writing languages. Well, unfortunately, they started to do parallel integration. Is that what they call it? Where you go backwards and include the functionality into this new language, and you create basically a bastardized language. And your programmers, who are so used to writing quick, easy programs in Focus or whatever it happens to be, start using this in a way it wasn't intended. It's very, very inefficient because it's kind of a hack to do these things. And what should have been, a simple reporting language does a whole lot more, and it really shouldn't have been used for that.
Mm.
So I don't know if you've ever had any experience with that type of thing. I don't know if you've...
No.
Again, most people have never heard of these things because they're in the mainframe world.
I heard of Focus once before. I don't remember who told me about it, but I haven't really done anything with those reporting languages. I don't know if Crystal Reports falls in that. It's not really. It's more like a report layout tool
right. Nowadays.
But I think that's kind of where the market for that for normal user applications has kind of gone.
Right. And Crystal Reports, which is actually bought by Microsoft and included in VisualStudio.net, comes with Crystal Reports now. Crystal Reports is the same thing in a visual environment. But
right. If
you've used Crystal Reports or seen it, Crystal Reports gives you a lot of control over using whatever fonts and laying it out on the screen and right justify, left justify. With these old reporting languages, you didn't have that control. It was just gimme, 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 and it would just spit the data out. It would, by default, put a comma between them or put five spaces between them and things like that, and that was pretty much it. You could go in and start manipulating a little bit, but you couldn't change fonts very easily. You couldn't, highlight words or bold or any of that kind of stuff. With Crystal Reports, you do because of the visual aspect of it. But yes, it is a similar thing except for the visual world. And since we touched on it, let's talk about SQL. And you and I both know SQL very well, very intimately. Sequential query language or structured query language. I've seen it referred to both ways. And SQL is a language that's designed and has been around for a long time to communicate directly with a database. There's, I can't think of the term offhand, DCL and DML, data control language, data manipulation language. Both types of SQL, but basically different syntax.
Mm-hmm.
SQL language is very universal. The standards have been around for years and years, because like I said, databases have been around for years, SQL has been around for years, but there are different flavors of SQL for different flavors of database. The underlying standard, select star from wherever, it's pretty universal, where, whatever criteria. There's certain things that are universal. However, each database wants to add their little extra nuances and extra abilities and features to it. So while standard SQL will work across Oracle and SQL Server and MySQL and Postgres, each one of those four things has their own little extra SQL. Oracle uses something called SQL Plus. where their way of designing and creating functions is a little bit different than, say, SQL Server. SQL Server syntax of creating functions and procedures and different function calls is a little bit different than, say, Postgres.
Mm-hmm.
So the SQL language itself is very universal. Now, what do you think of the future and the present of SQL as a programming language in... Well, first of all, should hackers be interested into it? Well, I have no idea why I can't put together that sentence. Should hackers be into this language at all? Is there any hacker use for it? And I think the answer will be completely different than the next question, which is, what about the job market for it?
Okay. Should hackers be interested in SQL? Yeah, I think they should. But as my forum title says, I am the data pillager. You know, I love grabbing data and stuffing it into a database and then later pulling it out and seeing what kind of, you know, correlations I can make between different things. I mean, that's the whole way that, you know, Bell's Mind started. I found some data, stuffed it in a database, built some queries with SQL, and now, you know, you can look up area codes and exchanges and all that stuff. I think that SQL in the hacking community is underutilized. There's probably a lot of things that people don't realize they can do with SQL that they may be trying to do in another, you know, in C or something like that with flat files or something that would SQL would make their life a million times easier. But I don't expect that people are going to learn it anytime soon. I think that people are going to kind of stick with Perl and all that and C and just leave SQL on its own. Some people use MySQL for some stuff, but MySQL, in my mind, really is not a real database. I've said this a million times. Postgres gives you all kinds of functionality that MySQL doesn't, and once you really get into SQL and build something big, you'll appreciate that. But hackers, yeah, I'd say it's hit or miss depending on the person's hacking interests, whether they should be interested in it. As far as the job market goes, though, I think that that I don't really, aside from maintaining a huge database for somebody, I think SQL is more of a part of your resume as opposed to the whole thing. I know some people like yourself, you deal a lot with databases, so SQL is, you know, a large percentage of your work. But I know at other places that I've worked, SQL was a small percentage, but a required percentage. You needed to know a little bit about it to get your job done, but you didn't need to be an expert in the field in order to get around the system. So that's what I think about it.
Yeah, actually, there is a very large market for SQL programmers. But when that being said, let me clarify, nobody's hiring just SQL program. You won't see that listed as the job title. You will see SQL Server 2000 programmer or SQL Server 2000 database designer. You have to know the whole package, including programming, as well as database design, because there is still a lot of stuff being done. And to give you some examples of real-world things that are happening, there is software out there. Specifically, what I do a lot of, let's use Amazon as an example. I'm going to try to make one up off the fly. Let's use Amazon as an example. Amazon has a huge database of information. Huge database. And I think we can all use our imagination. They've got books, customers, credit card database, reviews, all this information kept in databases. People are needed all the time to extract said information. People are needed all the time to modify and add new features to that. Let's say they wanted to add a new ratings system. They wanted to modify the reviews to have them weighted. They didn't have that in their initial design. They just have people reviewing it, and that's it. We want to add something that will weight it so that somebody who is consistently a good reviewer has more weight carried in their review or something like that. You have to have people that are going to be able to go in and modify that database. I may be mistaken, I may be misspeaking here, but I believe that Amazon is an Oracle-based data. I think the last time I heard they were an Oracle-based shop. So you need somebody who has experience with Oracle that can go in and modify and make changes to this data and maintain data integrity, make sure this whole system works, and be able to extract data on the fly. Because the other thing that happens, and as much as you want to hate this and deny this, and luckily, I don't have to do this for a living. I wouldn't do this for a living. But we all know that these companies, like I don't want to single out Amazon. I'm not accusing them, but I think we can pretty much make some assumptions. But a client comes to Amazon and says, hey, we want to buy 50,000 names, addresses, email addresses of users who have bought sci-fi DVDs over the past 6 months, so we can mass mail them whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You have requests like that that come in all the time, and you need programmers who, A, understand this giant system, understand where the data is and the relationships between them, that can pull out said data and put it into whatever format's required, whether it's a spreadsheet or another database or whatever, and deliver it. And there is a lot of demand for sending data back and forth, data to and from banks, data to and from other companies, data within departments of the same company. You may have within your company a database of all the employees. Well, let's say that over in the benefits office, they want to send out a flyer to everybody in the company to let you know that they're having their company picnic. You have people in-house that's their job is to extract that data and send it to the other part of the university. And to write interfaces, you may have a centralized human resources system, but you may outsource to the local bank for a direct deposit, where you're going to have to work with the bank to find out their requirements and their data requirements, their standards, what data they need and don't need, and how they transfer it, security, and all that stuff combined. And you're going to have to write a system that will interface with that and send data back and forth. So I'm kind of going a little long on this because I do this all the time. This is pretty much what I do for a living. So there are quite a few jobs out there, but they're on a specific database example. So if you can get Oracle experience, that is the biggest. SQL Server 2000 is a pretty close second. And as a matter of fact, there may be in more installations of it, but they're usually smaller. Oracle usually has the bigger places. But again, DB2. MySQL, which I agree with what you said earlier, it's very much a beginner's database. You know, it's not a true database. It doesn't have a lot of the features that the others do, but it's a great way to learn basic SQL. It supports SQL standards, doesn't do a lot of functions, stored procedures, and stuff like that, but it'll give you the basics of storing a database and relational database management.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever one you find interesting or whatever one you're usually going to be able to only get a job in that. I'm lucky enough to have experience in Oracle and SQL Server, so I can kind of adapt and migrate. And if you understand the overall concepts, and we had a relational database management show many shows back, if you are interested in that, that talked a little bit more about it. But I think that's enough on SQL. And I think the next language that I have on my list is probably the one that's most important of all of these. And that is, and I'm combining them, and I might, probably shouldn't, I guess, but C and C++.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're fairly important, I guess.
I think they're very important. I don't think there's anything I think they're the most prevalent language myself. I wish I could speak a little bit more intelligently on them. I have studied both. I've had both in college. I've never had the call to do them in real job, on-the-job requirements. Actually, that's a lie. I've written a Pro-C before, which was a bastardized C. I wrote Pro-C on a Solaris, on a Sun Solaris system before, and it was pretty god-awful. It was actually written in India, all the comments and documentation. It was rough. It was very rough to modify that one. That was pretty nasty. But as far as compiled languages, I think it's far more prevalent than what we mentioned earlier, Pascal, Fortran, that type of stuff. And C is definitely the language you're going to use if you're going to develop applications. And correct me if you disagree with this, but if you're going to develop applications under Linux.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, it ties in very closely to assembly language, like we were talking before. If you're going to build low-level applications, you're going to have assembly language plus C. But a lot of the times you want to have C++ because people say it's too bloated. You know, they want something as simple as possible.
Mm-hmm.
For system-level stuff, like the kernel is written in C for Linux for a reason. And that's it. You know, they don't use C++ for things like that. They use C++ for big applications, but system-level stuff is almost always done in C.
Exactly.
So.
Yes, very, very good point. And C also is a standard. I think it's, 1985 was the last time. I don't know. Yeah, I don't remember. See, there is an ANSI-C. ANSI-C is a standard that it makes it very portable. ANSI-C should work from one system to the other. However, the reality of that is not, this, unfortunately, the truth. Because C has so many functions that are custom to the environments, and people use them. If you do write in pure ANSI-C, theoretically you can take it from a Linux box to a Windows box to a Solaris box to a VAX to whatever, and it should all work if it's standard ANSI-C and it's supported by a compiler, which it almost always is. The fact of the matter is most people use a bunch of other functions. You would use include statements of different function and function calls that were only designed to work on a Windows box or a Linux box. Obviously, that's not going to port somewhere else. And actually, I didn't mean to touch on that, but since I mentioned the word port, anytime you hear about something being ported, the majority of the time it's C, in my experience. If something's written in C, it's usually the most portable language because you can try to find, well, the ANSI will port over easy, and you can try to find the equivalent functions from one environment to the next. It may be called one thing in Linux, and you may find an equivalent or similar for Microsoft, and you may be able to port it over from one environment to the other easily by simply finding out how the function calls work on one system versus the other.
Right.
But C++ gives you complete control, true object-oriented programming language where you can write any data structure that you want, you can write any function, do function calls, do... I've never seen a limit to what C++ cannot do. So if you're going to...
I worked on a software system back in the day called Target Junior. It was for computer vision, and it was a million lines of C++ code. And it was very complicated. It did all kinds of cool stuff, and it's a perfect example of how C++ can work on a large scale and get the job done, even when it comes to something complicated like computer vision. So...
Right, and I think that's probably the story here. That's the thing to take away from this, is if it's a large development, large program, C++ is invaluable. It is a huge demand in the job market. Although those are the ones most being outsourced, I even mentioned in my example to India, C and C++ is where a lot of jobs are. I won't say the most, because I think the next language we talk about, well, we'll see. There is a pretty good job job market for C and C++ programmers out there. As far as for hackers, I love it, and I wish I saw more hackers using it, but because of the complexity compared to Perl, a lot of people, Perl, as Nathir said earlier, Perl can do a lot of things, and it's faster to develop in Perl. So I think more people... from a hacking standpoint, more hackers will use Perl to get the job done before they'd use C and C++. C and C++ generally tends to work better for larger applications.
Definitely.
And C++'s bastard cousin, Java.
I love Java.
I know Voodoo Hal is pissed just at the way I already started my talk about Java. I know he's going to... not like that at all, but I can't stand Java. Java is supposed to be, and I'm oversimplifying, I admit, but Java is supposed to be C++ for cross-platform development. And it's an object-oriented language that's supposed to be universal, that you can write in it, and it will be supported across platforms.
Right. I do like Java for programming cell phones. It's cool, but... there are so many goddamn different versions of Java, and then different versions of Java that have extra packages added on and all this other kind of stuff, that it just becomes impossible to keep track. There's J2SE, there's J2EE, there's J2ME, there's personal Java. Mm-hmm. And when you get to J2ME for, you know, mobile devices, there's the Midlet profile and this CLDC, and there's like 50 different version numbers of everything. It's just really, really, really annoying to keep track of that. Like, it's not cross-platform anymore. Well, it's still cross-platform, but it's not easy to develop and run everywhere. Like, cross-platform is one thing, but they call it the language you can run everywhere if I have to use a specific version of Java. You know, to some extent it makes sense, but to the extent that it's gotten, with all these different versions, I think it's kind of missing the point now.
Yeah, and then you got JavaScript, Java Server Pages, Java Beans, Java Applets. Oh, it's just...
Oh, yeah, NetBeans. Like, there's all this other crap that goes with Java. You know, it can be a lot of fun to program in sometimes. Like I said, for cell phones, I've had a blast of developing a few applications in it. But, you know, pretty much I developed for one particular cell phone because I know that it has this particular Java environment on it, and, you know, it's got this a couple of these features, and I don't want to bother porting it to another cell phone because I don't think I should have to, but that's the way it turns out. And it's just a headache.
Well, there. That being said, there are jobs out there for Java programmers. I don't know if I'd say a lot or a few. I guess an average amount. There is demand for Java, but again, because of what you just described, if they're hiring for a cell phone development, they want you to know already, out of the box, J2ME, or whatever
right.
the job happens to call for. So it's one of those things that if you happen to, whatever you happen to learn in college, whatever class was available, if you learned, for example, you know, I had JSP, Java Server Pages. I had to do a project in JSP. I hated every second of it. It was excruciating having to do JDBC drivers connecting to ODBC drivers in Windows. It was just god-awful. I hated every second of it.
I forgot about JDBC entirely. JDBC is a piece of garbage.
Yeah, and it was just excruciating. It just horrible. So, however, because I do have a little bit of experience in that, if it did come up in a job interview or something like that, I could say that I have... You know, if they wanted to hire me to do J2ME, I wouldn't be able to say I could do that. If they asked me about JSP, I'd say, yeah, I know it, but I don't want the job. So, yeah, if you have the experience directly in a certain type of Java environment, like you said, and there's like 500 different ones, then, yeah, you should be good to go. But,
as far as Java jobs go, there's a lot of enterprise development stuff. That's why they have J2EE, like writing front ends. That make databases look pretty to end users. A lot of stuff in the medical industry and a lot of stuff in the financial industry uses Java for their front ends. I'm really not sure why. I guess they want to be able to run it everywhere, but you know, it's just poorly implemented, like you said.
Yeah, it was well intended, but poor execution. That's pretty much. And I mean, anybody who's used Java. Knows. It's slow, it's clunky, it crashes a lot, the stupid virtual machines and all that. I don't like it. But that's just my opinion. Like I said, some people, like Voodoo Hal, I know loves it. He loves it.
Mm-hmm.
But me, no, can't stand it. All right, we're going to keep going here, and we're obviously well over, in case you didn't figure that out, but we're going to go back and remove some earlier stuff, because this is a pretty good topic, I think.
Okay.
The big job market, and should we touch on this or should we go to the web stuff? Let's go with this. The biggest job market that I see is in the visual languages. You'll find more jobs out there for Visual C, Visual C++, Visual C Sharp, Visual Basic, really more than anything else. And I think we can lump them all together, actually, believe it or not, because what that means, something that's a visual language, is, A, we're talking Microsoft only here. We're talking about Windows development only. You're not going to write something in Visual Studio that's going to work on Linux, no matter what porting or libraries. It won't happen. I don't think it's possible. I don't think it can be done. I don't think anyone's ever written that or ever will.
Mm-hmm.
However, for Windows development, I have to admit, I like the new VisualStudio.net. The old Visual stuff was pretty, well, for Windows development, they had their pluses and minuses. But this last .NET, I think they kind of got some things cleared up, some good things. But let's back up. What is a visual language? Well, visual basically is referring to GUI development, graphical user interface, which is everything in Windows. See, in Linux, it's not all GUI. It's not all about the X. It's not all about X Windows. It's not all about clicking and pointing. You can write a lot of good and great applications that are completely from the command line, running servers and things like that. Small footprint. You don't have to have a bunch of overhead, memory-wasting libraries, et cetera, et cetera. And Windows, right. You do, by the nature of it. So if we go back even to Visual Basic, the early Visual Basics, Visual Basic is what the buzzword nowadays is RAD, Rapid Application Development. It's in very, very wide circulation. Businesses use it a lot because it's very simple. And it's called Rapid Application Development. It's a RAD tool because it automates all of the GUI processes for you. You get a canvas, and I don't know how to describe it if you've never seen it, but think of it as an art program almost. You get a canvas like in Paint, and you draw your buttons on the screen. You can drag and drop the buttons and your icons and your drop-down boxes wherever you want on that canvas and design visually what you want your application to look like, thus the name Visual Basic. And it takes care of all of the work in the libraries to draw the buttons for you and draw it. And when you click the button, it will take care of all of that for you. You just have to go in and say what happens. As far as the actual action itself, it automates that for you. And that's what Visual Basic has done, all the visual language has always done. The problem comes, and by the way, feel free to jump in on me here if you want to point something out.
Okay.
But Visual Basic, first of all, is not object-oriented. That's the one knock against it. Visual C++ is. Visual C++.
Oh, you know, I actually, to just jump in for a second, I know somebody who programs Visual Basic for a living, and I want to say that they told me the newest version of Visual Basic does have some object-oriented constructs, but it's not fully object-oriented. So just right. Throw that in. I'm not really sure what he meant by it totally, but I think Visual Basic may be heading to becoming object-oriented in the future.
Right, and I think I know what you mean, and I'll touch on that. That has to do with .NET and the .NET architecture. And yeah, I'll touch on that in just a second. But going back to the old Visual Basics, Visual Basic, and even back to Visual Basic 1, and a lot of people who have been around will remember that if you ever designed an application in Visual Basic, and a lot of freeware and shareware and stuff that's developed in that, you would always have to include something called vbrun100.dll.
Oh, God, I remember.
You remember this, right? And then when Visual Basic 2 came out, you had to include vb2, vbrun200.dll, and 300, etc. And that was a hassle because basically those DLL contains all of those function calls that were required for Visual Basic. If your program is compiled to use those function calls and you didn't have them there, you would get an error. So that became a problem because now you're having to deliver that DLL all the time and you get what was commonly referred to as DLL hell, because what happens if one program sends you DLL that's an older and or newer date than the one you already have? You never know which one to keep. What if one was compiled with different things than the other one had in it? They've got problems. It just caused all kinds of headaches. And you could write your own DLLs. In later versions of Visual Basic, you could write DLLs with your own function calls in them, but you would have to include them. And then you've got these complex installs where it's copying DLLs everywhere, and your system folder gets overloaded with all these DLL files. They're loaded into memory. They start draining your memory. They may have duplicate function calls and collisions, and it was just a giant mess. Well, with VisualStudio.net, they're going away from that, and they're going to something called I think it's called Microsoft Foundation Classes or Microsoft Class Libraries.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're able to interface. Okay, let me back up also. Visual C++ was similar as far as delivering the DLLs, and anything that was compiled in that DLL for Visual C++ obviously was only used by C++. It's like having a function in that code that would only work with Visual C++. It wouldn't work with anything else. With .NET, they've gone to a universal class library, where if you want to call something like, for example, a timer, you want to write an application that's a countdown timer, there's one universal class library called Timer that works in both Visual Basic and Visual C++ and Visual Sharp, C Sharp, or Visual Java, or whatever it happens to be. It's supported by any of the .NET. If it's written in the .NET architecture, it's universal across them. So when you say Visual Basic has some object-oriented constructs, you can write a function, if you will, that can be called by a Visual Basic program written in Visual Basic, Or it can be written in Visual Basic called by a C program, or written in C called by a Visual Basic, and vice versa. It's trying to blur those lines so that that is not a problem.
I see.
You still have to distribute all of those function calls somehow. And that's why over the past couple years, one of the critical updates, or one of the system, Windows updates, was the .NET architecture, the 1.1, the 2.0, and you had to download that. Well, that's because any of the stuff developed is going to use all those function calls. So they just have you download it all in one big batch up front. So you have all that stuff in your system. And with Longhorn, it'll come shipped with it. XP came shipped with most of it. Service Pack 2, et cetera, et cetera. So you have that on your system already, which kind of helps with the DLL problems. However, of course, you can still write your own DLLs and distribute them and stuff like that as well. So .NET is good in that it becomes a more centralized thing. That way you get the ability of Visual Basic to write out your application with the buttons and everything and make the rapid application development of how it looks and feels, and then still have the true object-oriented functionality of C++ so that you can write functions in C++ so that when you click a button, maybe it's easier for me to write a timer in C++ than it is Visual Basic. I write the front end in Visual Basic, the back end in C++, compile it all together, and deliver it out the door as one compiled application. So .NET is pretty cool about that. I happen to think so.
Well, let's not get started on ASP.NET just yet, because I have many gripes with it.
What's that? Yeah, ASP?
I said let's not get started with ASP.NET, because I think ASP.NET is a piece of shit.
Well, let's go into that now. Before we do, I just want to repeat again, there are a lot of jobs for visual programmers. A lot. Because the other thing about Microsoft is the whole integration thing, is not only have they integrated their languages, they all... part of those class libraries and a lot of the sample code and functions they come with, conveniently enough, tie into SQL Server. So they also give you a lot of pre-written code that's point and click to a certain extent that makes it easier for you to extract and insert database to Microsoft SQL Server or Microsoft Exchange Server. So if you are an all-Microsoft shop, it's very, very helpful and very useful. But again, it's only for Microsoft operating systems and Microsoft products. ASP.NET is the exact same thing, except that instead of doing the Visual Basic, which would be an application, an .exe file that you run, ASP is simply the web front end. You draw the buttons, you draw the drop-down list, or whatever it happens to be, the function calls, and embed it into a web page. ASP.NET will use all those function calls, except you have to have the browser instead of compiling an .exe file. But you don't care for ASP.NET.
No.
Are you eating?
I think ASP.NET.
You're eating on the show.
I'm starving. I didn't eat for the longest time.
Okay.
In any case, ASP.NET sucks. There's example code from Microsoft that does not work. It may work if you have all your server settings exactly the same way that they do.
Right.
But they conveniently leave all that out, which I think is ridiculous because I have complete vanilla default installation of everything. So it's almost as if I opened up the box, installed this crappy software, and then tried to use their examples, and nothing worked. So, and then I was using session variables and all this stuff that's very simple in other, web development languages. But it just didn't work in ASP.NET for some reason.
Or JSP.
So I made one or two. What's that?
I said JSP is pretty crappy with session variables also.
Yeah. But I made a simple change here or there, and then all of a sudden session variables started working. But because of the particular type of session handling I had, I couldn't store certain types of session variables. So, it's just a big mess, I personally think. It does do a lot of cool things that the other languages like PHP don't do by default. They you have to kind of emulate them. Like there's this application state variable where you can create global variables that are shared between all the users who connect to your particular ASP.NET application, which could be like a set of web pages or something like that. There's cool stuff like that. There's events like when somebody connects to your website, it starts a session, and after 20 minutes, there's an event that's called if there's no activity that closes the session. So you can actually you know, have code that sits in your server that will execute 20 minutes after somebody visits your site and do a little bit of cleanup or, you know, update some counters or something like that. That type of stuff is cool. PHP doesn't have it directly, but you can emulate it using, you know, if you know a couple of tricks here and there. So ASP.NET is on the right track to being something cool, but right now it's just a disaster, and I hate it.
Right, and that's a very good summary. It is on the track, too, and that's what all of the .NET, I say the same thing for all of it, it's on the track to the right way. It's going the right way. It's going the right way, but it's still got some problems from one installation to the other, like you said, problems from one installation to the another. If yours doesn't match theirs exactly, are you swallowing the phone or what?
No, I my phone's just cutting out. I don't know what the hell's going on.
Oh. All right, well, you also just mentioned PHP, so let's move on to that next. PHP, of course, is kind of the open source version of ASP, if you will. Not exactly. That's probably a bad comparison, but I called it a long time ago SQL for the web, and that is an oversimplification, but I think it's pretty accurate for a general description.
I like to personally call it Perl for the web.
Okay.
It's very similar syntactically to Perl, but has these SQL functions, you know, kind of built in it directly. You don't need to include anything except the compile time for PHP itself. You can use MySQL or Postgres or even Microsoft SQL Server or these ODBC databases. Personally, I think it's great. I don't know that there are that many. There are PHP jobs out there, but nowhere near as many as ASP.NET.
Absolutely.
But I think for hacking purposes, like, you know, not like rooting systems, but, I mean, for people who are just interested in technology, who want to start doing some web programming and want minimal hassle, they can get running with PHP very quickly. And there's a lot of example code out there. And for personal stuff, I don't think anything beats it right now.
Yeah, it's very Perl for the web is a very good app, is a very good description also. It allows you so easily to manipulate data. And we also would be remiss if we didn't mention just plain old HTML. I mean, we have to call that a language. You know, it's an interpreted language or whatever. But PHP is the server end, the code that you write, that's going to end up generating HTML. It's going to generate code that's interpreted by your browser. PHP is on the server side, which is why you don't see PHP code ever in a browser. You can go to schedule.php on the BinRev radio page. You're not going to see PHP code. You're going to see the HTML code that was generated by the PHP. So the PHP is kind of an intermediary language, if you will. It's going to read and write data from a database, which is why I call it SQL for the web somewhat. But yes, that is an understatement. It does all so many other things, very similar to Perl. It's got a lot of functionality, where with a lot of looping, a lot of if-then, cases, sessions, and a lot of things it can deal with, and then generate that web page. So it is very powerful. It's an open source version, open source web development that's, I guess you can say, cross-platform. I mean, any web is cross-platform for the most part, but I guess that's neither here nor there. So really that's it. And like you said, PHP, and I have to say this, it's an unfortunate reality, but truthfully, most of the Unix languages that we've mentioned are not big in the job market, with the one sole exception of being C++, in my opinion. The majority of the jobs that are out there are in the visual languages. So if you're looking at this from what should I study in school or what jobs are out there, there's a few mainframe jobs. I would not get into it if I was a young person. There are a lot of visual programming, visual languages. I absolutely would get into that if you're looking at what you want to do for a living. But if you're talking about it from a hobby standpoint and from a hacker standpoint of what you can do to write cool things and use for hacking purposes, whether it's data pillaging, like our good friend Not Theory here, or shell code or anything like that, I think your best bet would be studying Perl and C and or C++, because C++ can do just about anything. It is definitely complex, can be very complex, and even it's not simple to begin with, quite honestly, but you can do anything with it. C is what things like shellcode exploits are. any applications or tools, the majority of them are written in C++. I probably could have come up with a list if I would have thought ahead of time, but I can't. But C++ is definitely the way to go if you want to really... You can access memory registers and things like that. You can see what's going on through all of the other things from the operating system. You can peek in. I mean, it's just so powerful and such a great interface with everything else that's going on. So,
yeah, from C++ is never going to get old. You're never going to run out of things you can do with it.
Right.
It does pretty much everything.
So Perl and C++ for the hackers out there, if you really want to learn a lot of hacking stuff and develop some hacking tools. Or, of course, any of the things we talked about, it depends on what your needs are, what you want to do. If your hacking tool happens to be something for Windows with a button that'll convert binary to ASCII, for example, then do it in Visual Basic. It's simple. But if you're going to write something a little bit more system level, then C++. If you're going to write something repetitive to parse through data, go with Perl. Right tool for the right job. That's pretty much the summary of all of this.
Right, and actually there's another class of languages that we didn't mention. I'll just mention very quickly.
Sure.
Because somebody told me about it maybe a couple of years ago. This guy who I know who worked in industrial automation, he said still to this day, like systems that, you know, like laser cut pieces of steel and things like that, anything that does an industrial function like that, a lot of them still use a programming language called Forth. I'm not familiar with it, but... if you're interested in that type of thing, I'd say look up Forth, see who's using it, and I don't know. I can't say there's a large job market for it, but maybe fun to check out.
Right, right. Yeah, we pretty much focused on PC-based languages, and we also, I mean, this is not an exhaustive list. We just kind of thought of the ones we thought would be appropriate that people would be interested in, and we didn't mention Python. We didn't mention – there's a lot of them out there that we didn't mention that are nothing wrong with them, but so don't write in saying you missed this, you missed that. We understand that. You know, I think we focused on the major ones, and hopefully somebody got something out of that, because people ask the question a lot, what should I learn, what should I learn? Well, it depends on what your needs are. And the other thing I've always said, too, is I pride myself personally on being able to adapt to whatever the needs are. I've had so many languages through all of my years of high school, through college, through the work environments, and on-the-job training and stuff that I've had, that I feel confident I can pick up any language fairly quickly. If you understand concepts and understand loops, understand objects and object-oriented concepts, understand database and relationships between data, if you understand the general concepts, as silly as that sounds, and the theory, which I know Not Theory hates hearing they say that, if you understand the general concepts and the ideas of it, everything else is syntax, and syntax just comes with practice. So
yeah, that's very true. Well, like you said, you know, the constructs... looping, recursion, all that kind of stuff. You can learn anything.
Yep, absolutely. So. All right, well, that being said, I guess we'll wrap it up here. We had a very short email section today. Site of the week, I found myself reading The Smoking Gun while I was typing these up, so I'm going to say thesmokinggun.com is the site of the week. Nothing particular on there, just generally I go there. They have a lot of... they're very good at digging up police reports and finding out who's been busted for what and... kind of skeletons in the closet and things like that. And what about shout-outs this week? I think we both can obviously agree, shout-outs to everybody who participated in Freak Factor.
Definitely.
And what else you got?
I would like to shout-out two musicians who I don't personally know, but their music got me through the week this week. One is Ronnie Size, who's a musician from the UK, and another one is Richard Cheese and Lounge Against the Machine. He does lounge versions of pretty much any song you can imagine that's popular, and they are hilarious.
And, I'll shout out two musicians that help get me through every week, Jessica and Ashley Simpson. Thank you very much. Shout-outs to you. Just fantastic singers, performers, just amazing, amazing. That's a joke, by the way.
I can't believe I forgot that. I wanted them on my list.
Sorry, I already got dibs. We're going to close out tonight with something I found. It's a group called TRS-80, just reminiscent of the old TRS-80 computer systems, the trash 80s we used to call them, that I actually learned BASIC on in, like, sixth grade.
Nice.
And this track is called Dub Matrix. Always, as always, email us radio@binrev.com. Like I said, we cut back a little bit on the email this week, but we'll probably catch up on some of it next week. But we're going to start trying to focus back more on the main topics here. So we're going to try to really cut back on the email a lot because it's just taking up too much of the show. So, Not Theory, thank you very much for doing the show again this week.
Not a problem.
Always, always welcome to be on. We always like having you. And I think we covered some good stuff tonight. So I think we'll close it up and tell everybody that we will see them next week. Same hack time.
Same hack channel.